Welcome to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening and or good morning, as the case may be, and welcome to another edition of the best in live overnight talk radio. From the Tahitian and Hawaiian Islands, commercially out west, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north all the way to the pole, this is Coast to Coast AM. And I'm Art Bell. In a moment, coming up is going to be Peter Gersten. It looks like Peter had a really good day in court. We're going to find out all about it, what happened in Arizona. But let's put it this way. It doesn't look like it's going the government's way. So we'll have that update in the next hour. Joel Rothschild. He is perhaps the longest living AIDS patient in America today. And he's just written a book called Signals. And you know what it's about? I guess a friend of his had AIDS as well. And they made a pact that the first one to die would try to get a signal to the other. And he's written a book called Signals. I've got a whole lot of stuff I need to get on the air tonight, so I'll just sort of do the best I can, but I want to get this whole Arizona thing covered, what's going on down in Arizona, because it is very, very important. But first, I've got a sad note that I've got to get on the air. You may have been seeing on CNN, if you've been watching the late news, the news on the two small planes that collided in Chicago, with one of those planes landing on a hospital roof. Unfortunately, a colleague in the industry, Bob Collins, who had been hosting the morning program for my competitor in Chicago, WGN, was in one of those planes. He is dead. And there just have been too many lately. But Bob Collins, known to Chicago audiences since 1974, dead in a plane crash. We'll get more of that next hour. Or I'll hit on it again, because actually that's when Chicago, I think, joins. So in a moment, you're going to get to hear what happened in Arizona in a courtroom where I understand, thanks to you all, there was SRO, standing room only. And I guess Peter really laid it on him. That's coming up. All right, as many of you know, my wife and I saw a large triangular object float and not fly above our heads. Millions of other Americans have seen them. Peter Gersten filed a Freedom of Information request trying to find out about these triangular objects that those of us who have seen them know damn well are up there. And we didn't think, you know, you just keep batting against the wall and you don't think anything necessarily is going to happen, but you keep trying because you got to. Well, Peter went to court. In a precedent-setting hearing, a federal judge has now decided to consider a UFO group's claims that the government failed to conduct an adequate search for information about a very unusual aerial object. Well, hooray. In the Phoenix, Arizona federal lawsuit, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, that's our Peter Gersten cause, versus the Department of Defense Chief Judge Stephen McNamee, once again ignored the government's plea to dismiss the case. Hooray for you, Judge McNamee. Instead took under advisement the group's claim that the government was guilty of bad faith. Our government guilty of bad faith? In its search for information about a very unusual triangular aerial object. Though cause, which had brought the lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act in 1999, submitted numerous affidavits from witnesses who had observed the aerial object, The Department of Defense, ours, continues to maintain in court that it could find no information, none, confirming the existence of this object. And so they had like a 30-minute court go-round about all of this, and it looks like Peter is standing, still standing, and we'll find out right now. Peter Gersten, welcome.
Good evening, Arthur. Isn't that a song, I'm Still Standing?
I'm Still Standing, yeah.
I feel like I'm trying criminal cases in New York again, and the jury is out deliberating, and we're all waiting for a verdict.
Well, maybe you can give, I hear it was standing room only, is that true?
Yes, and I want to thank you for your help in getting the word out, because most of the people that came said they heard about the lawsuit on the Art Bell Show.
Right. Well,
thank you very much, my friend.
You're very welcome. Now, for those who were not standing in there, standing room only courtroom, what was it like? Can you give us, you know, a sense of how it came down and you know, the expression on people's faces, the tone of their voices, the things that we all can't get from the story?
Well, first of all, the energy was great. I had asked my membership to send me positive energy starting at 10 o'clock Arizona time, and the energy was terrific. It was really positive, and the courtroom was packed, and I had some of my closest friends there as supporters. Ted Lohman, the deputy director of CAUSE, came all the way up, and, you know, he's legally blind, came all the way up from Tucson to sit at the table next to me. We had Jim Delatoso there. We had some of my other friends who showed up, members of CAUSE. And then we had some people that came in. It's interesting because after I was on your show the other night, before I even hung up, I got a call from an individual who wanted to know if I wanted him to bring his friends down to federal court in order to be rowdy. So I suggested that this is federal court, and I don't think that's in his best interest.
Not a good idea.
But I think they were the ones that showed up with purple hair and green hair and things like that. And then a couple of individuals walked in the courtroom before the case was called with some cups of water and coffee, and of course you're not allowed to do that. Federal court is very strict and very conservative and very professionally run. It's totally different than state court. And you're not allowed to have audio or video equipment not only in the courtroom, but in the courthouse.
Well, that's why when on the evening news you see a description of a court case, you see only artists' renderings of what was going on. They sit out there and sketch what was going on because that's all they're allowed to do.
That is correct. So, and then they had some cases called before they called the CAUSE case, and they actually even admitted some attorneys into federal court right before they called the case. So I was watching the judge, and the judge was schmoozing with some of the new attorneys that were being admitted, and he was asking them about what alma mater they went to, and they were talking about basketball and the NCAA. So it was a pretty light atmosphere as well as high energy. So I felt pretty comfortable, and then they call the CAUSE case, and there's a podium, and each of the attorneys have to get up and speak in front of the podium, you know, looking at the judge. So I couldn't see how many people were coming in. And the court, I guess, held about 70, 80 people, and unbeknownst to me, while I was speaking, more people were coming in, and basically it was standing room only.
Right.
So there were close to about 100 people there that came for that particular case, that came for this case from all over, and it was great.
Do you think that that kind of attendance has any effect on a federal judge? You know, I mean, he can obviously see it's packed. There's tremendous interest in this. Would it have any subtle effect?
Well, I think maybe not generally, but in this particular case it might have, because one of his questions during the arguments was directed to the fact that I only had a sample number of affidavits from certain locations that he considered populated, and he wanted to know, if this object was seen in populated areas, how come I wouldn't have more affidavits? So basically I indicated to him that I could have produced hundreds and thousands of affidavits. These were just samples, and I alluded to the audience, and I made reference to the fact that I would say that at least half the people in the audience, if not more, has seen this object. So I would think the fact that not only was the audience packed, but it was full of people who were eyewitnesses to what it is that I was trying to prove existed, to infer that the Department of Defense would have to have information on it. I think for that effect, it was effective.
What was the other side of the aisle like? What kind of attorneys were there representing the DOD?
Well, it's funny because the DOD didn't even show up. I think they thought they had this
pocket. Excuse me? They didn't have any representation there at all?
No, I don't think. Heard afterwards, off the record, I don't think they're cooperating with the U.S. Attorney's Office. The U.S. Attorney was there. Two U.S. attorneys were there. The one that has been handling all my cases that causes brought, including the invasion case.
Right.
And he seemed so unprepared and so as if uncomfortable that he didn't want to be there. I was surprised because usually you would think that you know, central cosmic casting would send down somebody that was on an equal level so that you would rise to the occasion.
Yes.
And that's what I like, somebody who is at least at the same level so that I can rise to that occasion.
Yes, indeed.
Rather than lowering myself. But he was so, he got up, he spoke first because it was his motion, and he basically initially even conceded the fact that COAS had raised issues in response to his motion. He said they didn't reach the threshold of bad faith, but he, you know, so that was the concession right there. You know, before I even got up.
He admitted that you had raised valid issues.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, this judge was so perfect, as I was saying, that it was so well choreographed.
But he was arguing that these issues didn't raise to the level of bad faith.
Exactly. In other words, these were issues, but not issues that would change, would be a triable issue, would defeat a motion for summary judgment. Because all I had to do is raise a triable issue. A motion for summary judgment only exists if there are no issues in the case. In other words, if, in fact, they did a reasonable search, they found no documents, there's no issues.
Then he was an attorney, and of course I'm speculating, but he was just sent down there as a matter of course without any DOD consultation whatsoever and said, handle this case, and so what the hell is he going to say?
Yeah, it probably came close to that because the word is that the DOD is not cooperating with the U.S. Attorney's Office in several of the cases. As a matter of fact, before I even stood up to argue, he was still, you know, presenting his position, and the judge said, I have a question, before I even stood up, of the U.S. Attorney. And the question was, what is your argument as to Mr. Gersten's suggestion that the search that the DOD did was not specific enough?
That's good. Straight-out question.
Which showed me that the judge had read the motion and my response as well as each and every one of the affidavits. So the judge, and these are federal judges, and not only that, they were appointed for life. So somebody sent me an email tonight saying, well, what are you going to get from a judge? He's appointed. But they're appointed for life.
That's correct.
They don't owe any favors. And he's the chief judge, which I didn't know until I got there, the chief judge of the district.
Well, they sure don't owe any favors after the administration that has appointed them has passed on away, as administrations always do. Whether you might argue that appointed judges by the current administration might be subject to a little back pressure.
Well, I get, you know, they're subjected to certain concerns.
Yeah.
And if, in fact, the Department of Defense had found documents and had withheld them on national security grounds, like the government usually does in UFO cases, then I'm sure he would have sided with the government, as they all do in these type of cases, because how do you attack an exemption of national security?
Well, because that reveals a lie. I mean, if they were to say that, they would then be admitting a lie. The first lie, saying they had no information on any object of that sort or description. So if they said national security, then they would be admitting they lied.
Well, I mean initially. I mean instead of saying they didn't find any documents,
national
security.
Right.
Yeah, now I would say it's too late unless somehow they say, well, we went back and we did another search and we looked in areas we never looked in before and we found them. But now that affects national security. It's possible they can say that. But we're not even at that stage. The judge still has to decide. On my suggestion that he don't decide the motion for summary judgment, but put it over for 90 days and allow me during those 90 days to assist the Department of Defense in finding and locating the documents. Because there is no doubt in my mind that somewhere within the Department of Defense are those documents.
Yes, yes. How would you propose to assist DOD in searching through their files?
I would like the judge to give me subpoena power. In other words, allow me to subpoena certain military and civilian officials within the agency.
Peter, you're on a portable phone, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to have to either stay real close to the base or pick up a regular one.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
Yeah, as long as you're not moving, I think.
Okay, I'll stay still.
All right. I know it's exciting, but
you've got... Well, it's hard. the judge wouldn't let me move around during my argument.
Really?
Well, you have to stay at the podium, and during my summations in New York in criminal cases, I would move up and down the jury. I would walk over to, you know, different witnesses and things. So,
sure.
So that's it.
He's proposed... Or you proposed that you be given 90 days to work with DOD to help them find information on the on a triangular object that does in fact exist.
Exactly.
And so that's your argument right now. When does he come back and rule on that, in all likelihood, or is that simply unknown?
Well, he can rule anyway. He can come up with his own solution. He can decide on a hearing and bring in the witnesses and allow me to cross-examine them. As to this search, he can give me subpoena power and allow me to take depositions from some of the officials within the Joint Chiefs of Staff and and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. I can renew my application to subpoena and depose Stephen Greer and Peter Davenport, which he denied.
All right, hold it right there, Peter. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. Peter Gersten is here, and it looks like he won one, sort of. We'll be back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight, featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
But she lets me down every time. Can't make her mind. She's no one's lover tonight. With me, she'll be so inviting. I want her all for myself. Just the same.
Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
Good morning. Peter Gersten is here, and I think Peter's had a victory. There's no question about it. One resolution could be that Peter would get subpoena power, and in that way he could help the Department of Defense find the documents about the triangles that we know damn well are there. That'd be interesting. Subpoena power. where you could actually bring Department of Defense people in and put them under oath, something they'd have to think real hard about before they answered. And now that might almost be fun. Well, you know, I'm not sure that an attorney is supposed to think of it this way, but hey, Peter, if you got subpoena power and you could actually bring DOD people in to be deposed and put them under oath and ask them questions, would that be fun?
I don't try to do anything that isn't fun.
I think that would be grand fun.
I think it definitely would be fun.
And just to, if nothing else, to observe the expressions on their face as they realize they are under oath. I mean, that to me would be fun. Now, I may be a little perverted, but that sounds like fun.
Well, I heard it's more than a little. But in any event, I would videotape them.
Well, would you be allowed to take those videotapes and you do anything with them afterwards?
I would assume so.
Yeah.
Why not? I'm paying for them.
Well, in that case, that would be something to see. Would you just come straight? How would you approach, if I was a DOD official, what would you ask me?
Well, I haven't really sat down and thought about this. I have a list of questions that people have been sending me for the last 6 months, if I had the opportunity. But basically it has to do with the policies and procedures on UFOs in general, on these particular objects, on this search, the methods they do a search, the classification of the analysts that do the search. In particular, you know, hopefully this SD Form 472, where this declassification specialist Betty Good initially indicated that records were found. I hope this is the document, so-called smoking gun, that will sway the judge in favor of allowing me these additional.
People need to understand that originally, in response to the FOIA request, they come back and they actually check the box saying documents had been found.
Yeah.
Then that was followed up with a second document that said, "Oh no, documents had not been found." They checked the
same document.
Yeah.
Basically, it has component search results. One box says records found, and the other box says no records.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have in the records found box is an X that is blacked over, and in the no records box is an X. Now, of course, they would have to check the records found box first. Would there be no reason to check it after the no records? You know, so for some reason they checked that, crossed it out, and then checked the no records. Now, I don't know why. It's a regular form. Why they didn't just destroy the form and start over again with a clean copy. But it's funny because this judge was so open to my arguments. He was very sharp. He was an independent thinker. And usually, I can use a comparison. In a criminal case, when you sum up the summations, the closing arguments, you're supposed to confine yourself to the evidence that was introduced at trial and not
sure.
go outside of the evidence and make all kinds of inferences.
Sure.
Well, it's the same thing in the argument before the federal judge. I was supposed to confine myself to my responses that I had made, my arguments, on paper in response to the summary judgment motion and comment on that, argue those points and not argue points that weren't in those papers. But in referring, it's funny, I think I'm hanging out with Richard too much. In referring to this SD Form 472, where it initially had record found checked and then crossed out, then no record, I said to the judge, there is some belief that within the Department of Defense there are the good guys for disclosure and the bad guys who are for secrecy, and maybe this is some type of message from the good guys that there are records.
You're right. You've been hanging out with Richard too long.
I know, right.
That was good, though.
Right.
That was good. So
he didn't stop me, and he was receptive, and I even brought in Roswell. I said, we're not looking for an object that crashed 52 years ago in a place in New Mexico, and he smiled a little bit at that. I said, we're looking for an object that's seen almost every month, and
that's
as
right.
recently as 2 weeks ago,
that's right.
and that wasn't in my papers either, as recently as 2 weeks ago in Illinois.
Well, you know, Peter, you've got airline pilots, 747 pilots if you need them. You've got policemen in the state of Illinois if you need them. You have really significant professional witnesses, and I don't see how they can stand up to that. And it almost sounds like they don't want to stand up to it.
Well, are
they going to let you be the guy who removes his finger from the dike and starts a flood? Do you think they might let you be that guy?
Well, I would think so. I would, in choreographing this script before I came into this 3D reality, I would think that would be part of the script I would do for myself. In auditioning for the role of the UFO lawyer, I think that was one of the, things I had to audition for. So with my creativity and imagination, sure, I would program that into my cosmic computer program when I came down here and became the UFO lawyer. Why not?
And why not?
Good to me. And you're part of it. If it wasn't for you, Cause wouldn't be where it is today, and we wouldn't have those people in the courtroom. Because it was in January of 1998, after being on your program, that I resurrected Cause and made it an internet organization with a website that is now, with the same web wizard, Keith Rowland. It's unbelievable. And you are a main co-conspirator in this whole thing.
God, I hate that language. Main co-conspirator. Yeah, I guess I am. Well, I hope that it results in something. Anything. What is the most likely, or in order of likelihood, what are the most prominent possibilities of resolution here, or next step?
As you mentioned, there's plenty of evidence out there that the object exists, reliable,
yes.
Responsible, credible evidence.
Sure.
But that's not the issue. The issue is, separate and aside from whether the object exists, is whether a reasonable search, that's the law. All they have to do is a reasonable search, not an exhaustive search, a reasonable search. So the question is, and they have to accept, the judge has to accept the affidavits from the DOD at face value. In other words, unless I can raise an issue of bad faith, then they're presumed to have good faith, and the lawsuit's dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that this SD Form 472, as well as the other arguments I made about the predisposition of the DOD prior to any appeal on my part, they ignored my initial appeal. They saw Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, and that was enough to send me a denial without even doing a search. So hopefully my arguments were persuasive, and if they were, then the court can do several things. And it wasn't until I suggested that they not rule, that the judge not rule on the motion until 90 days, and allow me to assist the agency in trying to find the documents. And if I can't get any closer in 90 days, come in and dismiss it. What's the sense? They say they can't find it.
Right.
I don't know, can't tell them where to look. Dismiss it. He started making notes. He started writing a little bit for the first time.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know. I'm very hopeful. He was very receptive.
So you gave him, what you really did was give him an out.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. Now you have to also remember that this case has a far-reaching effect beyond UFO disclosure.
I have one really important question,
Go
Peter.
Ahead.
In your opinion, would it be, I don't want to say legal, would it be something the government would do in response to an FOI request of the sort that you made, if there is a national security issue at stake here, for them to reply no? In other words, under the guise of national security, could they politically check the no box and get away with it?
Well, that would be deceitful, and I only can go by past experience. In the lawsuit against the Central Intelligence Agency, they found documents, stated they found documents, and withheld them on national security grounds, which was upheld by the District Court and the U.S. Court of Appeals. The National Security Agency searched their files, found documents, stated they found documents, and stated we're not giving them to you on national security. That was upheld by the District Court, the U.S. Court of Appeals, and the U.S. Supreme Court. So there's precedent for the Department of Defense saying we have documents, you're not getting them, national security, and I'm sure Judge McNamee would uphold that decision.
God, that would just start a firestorm by itself, though.
Well, you'd get a lot of publicity.
Yeah, you sure would.
You know, you would get an acknowledgement that the object exists at least. But you know, basically, the agency has done it in the past, and they're still, you know, the CIA is still withholding the 57 documents after, what, 20-something years?
Yeah, I noticed also the president just the other day, without referring to Area 51 by name, said the military facility or secret facility near Groom Lake, and he signed another document holding that as secret.
Yeah, of course. They would withhold the documents, national security. It might get some attention in the beginning, and then it would blow over like it always does.
Sure. So, how do you most effectively use the time you've got?
Which time is that? Until the judge decides or once he decides?
Well, if he gives you the time. If he doesn't decide, in other words, he decides not to decide right away.
My time won't start until he decides.
Yeah, but then what?
If he's going to give me, well, then I'm going to sit down and I'm going to, you know, speak to some of my associates, and I'm going to put out some queries on my website, and we're going to go forward. We're going to, you know, like we would in any kind of case, we would plan strategy. We would decide who we're going to subpoena, when we're going to subpoena them. I would speak to the U.S. attorney and try to do it.
What kind of positions would you subpoena?
I'm sorry?
What kind of positions would you subpoena? I say that as opposed to asking you for names.
Well, it depends. The judge might set certain limitations on my subpoena power. In other words, he might say, well, start out with the person that submitted the affidavits.
Right.
All right? Start out with Betty Good. You can start out with interrogatories. You can submit 100 questions to the DOD. Okay, we can do that. You can subpoena your civilian researchers. Or submit a list of people you want to subpoena, and the U.S. attorney or the DOD can select like 10. But me, I would start at the top, Secretary of Defense, if I had a choice.
Well, they probably won't let you.
No, they won't let me. But basically, in any civil suit, if you subpoena an officer of the corporation or the corporation, they can supply any person who has knowledge and information about the subject matter that's the basis of the lawsuit. So somebody who would be in the position to provide information, assuming they had the information.
All right. As usual at this juncture, I would ask, what would you like the large audience out there to do to help?
Well, first of all, they can support a cause by going to the website and signing up for the free cause updates, the mailing list.
Yeah, it comes to your email, folks. Free. I mean, just absolutely free. All you've got to do is sign up, and you get this daily report of what's going on in the world of ufology. Free of charge. You can't beat that price. And that website is?
www.caus.org. And if you don't have a pencil with you, then just go to our site, because there's a link there.
Okay. And now, so they sign up for it. It comes to their email. You also have a newsletter?
Yeah, there's a newsletter that I don't know if they can sign up for that on the website. Well, if they have access to the website, they wouldn't want to sign up. But if they don't have internet access
right. Or
email access,
that's a lot of people.
They can write to CAUSE and sign up for the monthly newsletter, which is the highlights of the daily CAUSE updates. Now that address is CAUSE, CAUS, 8624. San Bruno, SANBRUNO, two words, Drive, Scottsdale, Arizona, 85258. And we have to charge because there's printing and postage.
Obviously.
And that charge is $20 for 12 issues.
All right. That's not at all expensive. No problem there.
No problem.
Once a decision is made by the judge to give you the time, then will there be anything the audience can do, or is it still you and your colleagues, or is there any way we can all help out?
No, that's very optimistic, because it's possible the judge can eventually grant the government's motion and dismiss it by saying, I did not raise enough issues of bad faith. But I agree with you. I think he's going to give me the time, and once he does, then I will come back on your show and say we have to raise some kind of legal fund for these depositions, for the transcripts, for the videotaping, for the court reporters, for the travel expenses. because as far as I'm concerned, that's what I want to devote my next 90 days to, doing this and doing as many people as possible.
Well, if you can get the time and if the judge rules your way, I'm confident that we can raise enough money to get the depositions done. I'm really confident. So,
well, then let's ask your audience to focus in on Judge McNamee and send him positive energy to rule in favor of cause.
All right. Let's do that. Again, toward proving, you have to prove in some way that they acted in bad faith, that they didn't conduct enough of a search. Do you think that, for example, you mentioned opposing the young lady that answered your form.
Right.
That would be pretty interesting to do, wouldn't it? Because you're obviously going to early on ask her, excuse me, why did you put the check mark over here?
Exactly. It'll be like cross-examining a police officer in a criminal case again. They always make mistakes. And I said that basically this form is more than just an inference of indifference. It's possibly the smoking gun. It's possibly bad faith. And, as I indicated before, as Richard would say, it might be even a message that, you know, subpoena me and I'll tell you where the documents are. So, yeah, I would love to talk to her.
I've run into that before. A lot of people are hesitant because they don't want to lose their jobs, of course. And so they want to be forced to tell what they know, and they feel once they're forced that the burden is lifted from them and they can talk.
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess I've learned too much about law over the last couple of years, Peter.
Unfortunately.
Unfortunately. All right, my friend. Carry forth. A warrior of justice is the way I think of you, and one way or the other, it looks like we're going to find out something. At least we're going to rattle their cages. Peter, thank you.
Well, thank you, King Arthur.
Later.
Good night.
That's Causes Peter Gersten. And, yeah, you can go to his website and sign up for the free update. And it's one of those things that's really worth getting in your mailbox. Find out what's going on out there. And you can't beat the price. It's dead free. If you don't have the internet, why, there is a newsletter, and that's relatively cheap. I'm Art Bell, and coming up next, I've got a whole variety of things for you, so don't touch that dial.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
We've been traveling far.
Yeah.
Radio Network presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired February 8th, 2000.
Last hour, we spoke with Peter Gersten, who had a kind of a victory in an Arizona court, trying to encourage the Department of Defense to go back and look again, do a more thorough search, and find whatever they've got on this triangular object. So it's a victory, in my opinion, for the good side. And you can kind of sit back in a lot of ways and wait and see what's going to happen. You can join the cause. That's CAUS, a website. It's linked through mine. And when you do, you'll get a daily free report about what's going on. And you can bet this is going to be highlighted in that. So thanks to everybody. Standing room only in the courtroom as Peter stopped them in their tracks. Now, I've got a number of things that I really would like to cover. My sympathies to the family of Derek Thomas. As you know, he just died after an automobile accident. It's, there've been a lot of very untimely deaths lately. Derek Thomas was one of those, of course. And also I note that Bob Collins, who did the morning show and has done so for about a decade now on WGN in Chicago, who is a private pilot, today collided, had his private plane collide with another private plane. You may have seen all of this on CNN. Well, piloting one of those planes was Bob Collins, 57 years of age, who had been doing the morning show and very well known in Chicago, and to all of you in Chicago, for a full decade now, is dead, much too early, at 57 years of age. So, a colleague in the industry, and my sympathy, of course, to his family as well. So there seems to be a lot of that going around. In a moment, you're going to be hearing from Joel Rothschild. Joel is perhaps the longest surviving AIDS patient, AIDS survivor in the world. He's written a new book called Signals. So he's here not just to talk about AIDS, but about signals. Now, what do we mean by signals? Well, signals from the other side. Because before his friend died, they made a pact. They made a pact together that whichever one went first would attempt to send signals from the other side. And in talking to Joel just before the this hour began, he said, "What are you looking for?" And I said, "Just the truth." So that's, I hope, what we're going to get. I trust what we're going to get. And it's yet another attempt to find out if there really is more to this world than the material world that Mr. Lennon was calling for us to ignore in the bumper music coming in to this hour. Should be a very, very, very interesting interview. There is so much going on out there right now that I want to comment on, that I've got to get a word in on, that I hope Joel will be patient with me. Number one, I do not send you to the web for idle stuff, but we've got a photograph up on the web right now which I would like your interpretation of, please. It's obviously a legitimate photograph. The picture taken by, well, I don't know who took it. It's of Mike. And it was taken on his prom night. You know, everybody takes a picture on their prom night, right? And, but Mike's picture, when you look at it, you're going to go, "Oh, my God." Located in the chest and stomach area, you're going to see what I would describe as a demon. This is not a double exposure. Whatever it is, it's really there. and it's really visible, and when you see it, it's going to remind you. You know what it reminded me of? You remember the monster? Oh, let's see, which movie would most closely resemble what I think is on his chest? I'm going to give that a little thought. It's a, you know what? I'm not going to tell you because I would like you to form your own opinions. It is easy to see, perhaps not at first. Turn the light up on your monitor if you don't see it. But it's on his chest, and that's a ghost, or in my estimation, some kind of demon. It is a shockingly a good photograph, and so I would not idly send you up there. I'm telling you, we got a whopper up there right now. So go take a look. It's in the new items section. Let me see. It's newest site additions. You'll see the story on the tragic death of radio personality in Chicago first, and then new ghost photo with description of haunted house. But boy, when you see what's on that man's chest. So, www.artbell.com. That's my address, www.artbell.com. The reason I think ghost photographs and demon photographs are so important, well, that should be obvious. If we are on a quest to try and prove something, then when you occasionally get your hand on really good forensic material of this kind, it's irresistible. And so go take a look and you tell me what's on that man's chest. You tell me. Latest news on the Alaska Airlines tragedy is that radar signals may show a piece of that plane may have broken off before the final one-minute descent to the ocean floor and death for everybody aboard. There have been too many coincidences lately involving the MD-80 series. On Saturday, an Alaska Airlines MD-83 returned to the airport in Reno, Nevada, minutes after taking off for Seattle. NTSB is investigating now, said, though it probably was caused by an overheated stabilizer motor. On Thursday, an Alaska MD-80 taxiing toward the runway in Seattle experienced intermittent problems with the stabilizer motor. An American Airlines MD-83 flight out of Phoenix returned to the gate last week after a stabilizer problem, and they think it may be a faulty control switch in the cockpit on that one. But this is getting pretty weird, I would say. Now, the only explanation that you could offer for this seemingly impossible chain of coincidence regarding the MD series of aircraft would be that after an accident of this sort, pilots are particularly sensitive to MD-80 stabilizer hiccups at all, and so we're hearing more about it, maybe. Or there really is something going on. And if that's the case, you begin to look for any common thread, obviously, between any of these things and where that would take you. Then they said an asteroid would hit Earth, possibly, in the year 2022, and then they said, no, it won't. Now, whatever happened to the, we're going to wait 3 days before we announce this and do the math? Didn't we just go through this a little while ago? Asteroid's going to hit, then it's not going to hit. So anyway, the latest math says it will not hit. Personally, I wouldn't put a lot of faith in math structured on what we know about something that might or might not happen 20-some-odd years from now, because just a slight encounter with something out there that would change, even the Earth's encounter with the Earth might change it just enough. You know, you never really know. There's cyber terrorism going on out there. eBay was shut down. Buy.com was shut down. Hackers, people with denial of service, and they're just essentially doing what I do when I send you all up to my website to see a ghost photograph. So many people hit it with requests at one time that the server can't take it, and it goes and dies. Now, that occasionally occurs when I send you all up like this incredible ghost or demon photograph is more like it. Some of you may be denied service for a little while trying to get in to see it because so many people are trying to see it at once. So hang in there. You obviously will get through after a while. But this looks like an orchestrated effort to deny service to cause trouble for e-commerce companies, and the FBI is going to catch these people. And when they do, they won't like it. The people. All right, now, Mr. Rothschild coming up. He wrote the following. This story proves there is more to heaven and earth than has been dreamt in the minds of men. An illuminating and inspiring read signals the book is wonderful proof that we are never apart from those we love. That's a quote from Deepak Chopra. The AIDS pandemic was over 12 years old in 1994. AIDS, the leading killer of men between the ages of 25 and 40, and hundreds of thousands of people had already died from this disease. Nowhere was the devastation more horrid than amongst urban gay communities. Tragically, it enveloped the lives of two best friends in Los Angeles. Having AIDS, they feared, obviously, their deaths to be imminent, so they made a pact. They promised if there was a possibility to contact the other after death, they vowed to try. Skeptic Joel Rothschild was the one who got left behind. Signals, his book, chronicles a series of miraculous experiences and coincidences that offer proof of an afterlife. His cynicism fading, his health improved, and he is now one of our nation's longest living AIDS survivors. His forthcoming book is an engaging true story of love, hope, and healing. It will take you on an adventure that we are going to take you on tonight. Here is the author of that book, Joel Rothschild. Joel, welcome to the program.
Art, thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm glad to have you on.
And, you know, the best place to start is in the beginning. You know, there's another pact that Albert and I have. It has to do with the first bit of proof of life after life. It wasn't just this one pact. And I have to tell you that I was a card-carrying member of the National Atheist Association for 10 years.
Oh, really?
Madeline got my money, yeah. So I was as skeptical as anybody could be, and I went along with the pact to pass.
Well, that's not even skeptical. If you're a,
a doubter.
Yeah. Well.
No faith.
Well, if you're an atheist, actually, don't you almost have faith? There is no God. Doesn't it go beyond just simple skepticism?
Absolutely.
All right.
Now I'm going to tell you, we had another pact that got violated, and that has to do with the first signal from beyond. At this time, in the early 90s, there was no hope for people with AIDS.
That's right.
There was a closed window. There was none of the new drugs. There was no hope.
It was a death sentence.
Absolutely. And at that time, I had already lived through pneumocystis pneumonia several times. I expected to be dead. And actually, my doctors told me that I would be dead in about a year and a half.
In what year did you contract AIDS or find out that you were positive?
Full-blown in 1986.
Now, let's back up. When did you find out HIV positive?
Well, I found out as I was full-blown.
Oh.
I found out with pneumocystis. But let me skip ahead if I can.
Sure.
We, Albert and I and a couple other friends, decided another thing that we would do. We went down to Mexico and we got the suicide drugs because we all felt, my little group of friends, there were certain things that could happen physically that we wouldn't want to live with.
Yeah.
And my particular thing was, I thought if I lost my eyesight, I wouldn't want to live. Well, Albert, my best friend since high school, whom I had the pact with about signaling from beyond, was the one in the group that was in perfect health. June 1st, skipped a point. The pact with the suicide was, with Albert and myself, if either one of us decided to take our own life, we would support the other, that we would be there with that person, we would help them to die. And this may sound very morbid, but that's what life was like.
No, it doesn't. It sounds realistic.
That's what life was like at that time. June 1st, 1994, 11 o'clock in the afternoon, I go over Albert's house, and I find his dead body. He took the drugs without calling me.
Oh, God.
Okay? Find his corpse. And that was the ultimate betrayal. This is a best friend, lifetime friend, never lied to me about anything. At that moment, the pact about life from beyond meant the signals from beyond meant nothing.
Nothing. Why do you think, and I'm sure you've thought about this a million times, that with health, when he had not yet begun to deteriorate.
Why did he do it?
Yeah, sure.
Well, there were a lot of issues, you know, and there were a lot going on with his life. All of our friends were dying. He really couldn't bear to see me get sick, and that was a big part of it. But here's the first signal. This is the first time I had held a dead body. On one hand, I was crying. I was devastated. On the other hand, I was angry that he had taken his own life. So angry, I was shaking his body.
Yeah.
The coroner arrived. The police arrived. I'm screaming. I'm hysterical, and I'm not rational. And in the midst of all, and there's no note, no explanation. And I needed an explanation. I needed to know.
Why?
I needed to know that he loved me when he was alive. If he wrote my name across the sky in a rainbow, at that point it didn't matter because he had violated this commitment that we had and not said goodbye to me.
Yeah.
It was horrible. Anyway, the very first signal, I hear his voice. I'm holding a dead body, and I hear his voice, and he says to me, "Get yourself together, hop the wall to the house next door, go in the trash, and you'll find a note."
What?
Yeah, that's what happened. The very first signal, and I didn't have time to think about it.
Hold it right there.
Okay.
We're already at the bottom of the hour because I consume so much time with what I wanted to get to you. I'm sure you can see why we're going where we're going. We're talking about what exists if there is something after this life. Now, I was about to suggest to Joel that his mind in that condition might well hear voices. But not voices that would instruct in that manner, that's for sure. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Stay right there.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight, featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000. listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
Wondering what's on the other side? This morning's show might be productive. Keep listening. My guest is Joel Rothschild. He has AIDS. He's still alive. Somehow, he made a pact with his friend who took his life early, committed suicide. And we'll pick up exactly where we left off in a moment, which was at the discovery of his friends. Okay, like Peter Gersten, with respect to the search for this thing we know is in our skies, flying in our skies, we know it's there. We're looking for the truth. And toward that end, there are several areas that I look toward when I'm trying to figure out this great question for humanity, and it's the biggest question I think any of us have and will ever have in our lifetime, as well as our greatest mortal fear, that is of death and whether there is anything that follows it or whether it's just lights out. The worms crawl in and the worms crawl out and all the rest of that. I cannot think of any greater question. Can you? I don't think so, because there's so much at stake. Well, I look at a lot of things. I look at forensic evidence, and one piece of really good evidence is up on the website tonight. It's a photograph of Mike. And I'm telling you right now, what's on his chest can only by me be described as a demon. You look and decide for yourself. I don't frequently, you know, I get a lot, I can't tell you how many supposed ghost photographs I get, and I only very occasionally call attention, probably 1 out of 100. This one you better see. It's on my website now at www.artbell.com, and I would appreciate one way or the other your comments on it. It's not a fake. You know, whatever's there is there. I guess it could be some sort of trick of light and shadow. I sound like NASA, don't I? But I don't think so. And then, of course, there's my guest tonight. By the way, the foreword to his book called Signals was written by, guess who? Neil Donald Walsh of Conversations with God, who did a guest host slot here a few nights ago. He wrote the foreword to the book. We'll talk a little more about that. But Joel and his friend had gone to Mexico to get the appropriate medicine to make final exit. You know, they had AIDS, and it was at that time an absolute death sentence. And for some reason, Albert, though he was still healthy, decided he was going to go and go right then. And unfortunately, Joel was the one to find his body was shaking his body. And a voice said to jump the fence, go next door, get into the trash can, and you'll find a note. And that's where we left off, I think. Welcome back, Joel.
Thanks, Art. And that is where we left off. I did it with the police there. LAPD was there and saying to me, don't go. You can't trespass. I jumped. I was frenetic. Crazed. I jumped in there underneath cat litter and debris. I found his last written note. That was the beginning, Art. That was the beginning of 2 years of miraculous and events that are documentatable. And I think prove, and Neil, as Neil says, prove that there is life after life. That was the very beginning. That was the very first thing that happened. And I questioned that. I thought, well, could I have put that into my own mind to go into the trash next door? Could I?
I say no.
And that's, let me tell you, that's not the only type of event that happened.
No, we'll get to the others. Yeah. But my answer to your question is no. A lot of things I can imagine could have happened, but to direct you next door to a trash can to get a note for a suicide for a body you were holding, no, not coincidence, definitely not. Might I ask why he decided to go early? Did he explain that in the note?
Well, he did. He had lost a job. He had lost another friend of ours had just passed away, and he was tremendously fearful of losing me. And I was very sick at the time. And he was depressed.
Yeah.
Depressed with AIDS.
Yeah.
But that note got me home. That night, I experienced him coming to me again.
Yeah, but back up again.
Okay.
What did the police say? I mean, you come back over.
You know what the police said?
And you know what?
You know what the police said to me?
What?
The police said, it's very common for people who are committing suicide to leave notes in trash. That's what the policeman,
That's what they said to you?
That's one of the policemen said, very common to leave notes in trash.
That's how they explain you're jumping a fence to a neighbor's trash can?
But I didn't even say that I did. At that moment, I didn't say, well, I just heard his voice to go in the trash. They just thought I was crazy. I said, I got to go over there. And I just hopped the wall. The police thought I was crazy. My friends that were there thought I was insane. And what is he doing? And I came back with the note, and I had this sense of peace.
You know, if I was a cop, I might regard you with some suspicion. I mean, that's so beyond all reasonable coincidence that I might look at you a little warily for having that kind of knowledge.
Well, glad that didn't happen.
It didn't happen, huh?
Yeah, glad that nothing like that happened. And that was, you know, that was the beginning. That was the very, very first thing that happened.
Okay.
And, you know, I'd like to tell you about a couple others.
Please.
And some of the other ones you might consider a coincidence. Some might be stronger. And I'm not, you know, there's so many that I don't know where to begin. But I'm going to tell you a small one, and you tell me whether or not you think it's a coincidence or you think it's proof of life after life. One of the things that I've always done is I collect quotes, and I collect quotes for friends. And my quote for Albert was a Benjamin Franklin quote, "Best friends are one soul in two bodies." He copied me at everything in life. I got a Harley, he got a Harley. I got a tattoo, he got a tattoo. So he found a quote for me. It was an ancient Chinese proverb, meeting is the beginning of parting. Very sad quote, hated the quote.
Well, it's kind of like living is the beginning of dying.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, year after he dies, I'm in a thrift store going through a bunch of old books. I find a book called The Wealth of Friendship from 1878. Compilation of quotes. Buy it for a buck, take it home, reading it, get to the middle of the book, there's a bookmark acid etched and stuck on the page. One quote in the entire book was underlined. Meeting is the beginning of parting. Is it a coincidence? I don't know. You tell me. I had.
To me, it would not be. No. Okay. To me, it would not be.
I had so many events like that.
Impossible.
Well, I'm gonna. And thank God that some of the events were witnessed. And I'll tell you a type of event that got witnessed, because otherwise I would have thought I was cracking up.
Right.
It was so overwhelming. He had a thing about hummingbirds, and I'll skip the whole story about why he had a thing about hummingbirds. Twice since then, I was consoling sick friends. One was on the 10th floor of a high-rise building in Los Angeles. My friend Rita Wainer, her husband, wrote all the music for Lee Wainer for Billie Holiday and Bessie Smith. A hummingbird flies in the window and lands on me. That's happened twice. Happened in my home here in Los Angeles. I was consoling another friend, Ed Auger,
yes.
And his partner had just died. Hummingbird flew in the room and landed on me. Does that happen? Is that a coincidence? I don't think so.
No, that doesn't happen.
And one time at night...
Once in my life, I saw at an airport outside, it was really interesting, a hummingbird came right up to somebody's nose, literally just sat there in front of his nose, and it totally freaked him out. That's the only time I've seen a hummingbird approach a human, and that was outside.
Okay, let me tell you one other. You know Neil Donald Walsh, and he's a good man.
Yes.
Okay, I've never met Neil Donald Walsh. He got a hold of my manuscript to his secretary, read the book, fell in love with it. But I got to tell you, here's a signal that happened with Neil Donald Walsh, okay? Neil took my manuscript, his secretary fell in love with it, she put it in his luggage, he was doing a European tour, he carried it all over Europe, and he writes in the foreword to my book that he got to the Piazza Michelangelo, he's looking at the River Arno, and he felt this huge urge, compelled to read my manuscript. And he reads it, and he calls it the treasure of treasures for which every thinking person has ever searched. It meant a lot to me because it meant that people would read my book and read my story. What's the coincidence? 1 month before Albert took his own life, we were in a thrift store downtown L.A. We bought an engraving, and he actually picked it. I said, you got to buy this. You got to take it home with you. I didn't even like it. What was it an engraving of? The Palazzo Michelangelo, the view looking at the River Arno.
Oh, boy.
Is that a coincidence? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either.
These things happened for 2 years.
2 years.
And some very, very powerful, some much more powerful and much longer stories than we have time for on the radio. And,
oh, we have time for a lot on the radio.
Well, I'll tell you.
I'm not stuck for time.
All right, well, I'll tell you a really, I've thought about these things over and over and over again. And I'll tell you the most powerful of all of them, and I feel like a little like Jodie Foster in the movie Contact. I don't know if you saw the movie, but she comes back and she
only about 10 times.
Okay, and what does she have as proof? Only her own story. So this is the worst for me to. This is the hardest story for me to tell you, because it's the most powerful signal and the most powerful contact, and I don't have a witness. It's just myself.
Sure.
The night he died, I got home, and it's about 2 o'clock in the morning. It's a hot California night. I had the air conditioning on. The blinds were drawn. I had blackout shades. My room was pitch black. And I know this is going to sound like a typical life-after-life story, but there was a light. There was a veiled, dim light above my bed. And he says to me, "You know it's me, don't you?" And I was frozen. Absolutely frozen. And in that moment, I was ready to take my life because I had lost my best friend. I had lost all faith, all hope. And he says to me, I couldn't even move. I couldn't even acknowledge.
At the point that this happened, one of the possibilities that you would have to consider is that this was coming from your own mind.
Grief, yeah.
You know, a grieving mind, sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this event, which was the most powerful event, I seriously have considered that over and over and over again, except for one thing. What had happened wasn't something, and what he said to me wasn't something that I ever intended to write a book or to share, and the message in what he told me that night carried me through the rest of my life, carried me through chemotherapy, carried me through AIDS. The message that he said to me was that every moment of life, every breath you take, good or bad, happy or sad, in pain or not, all have meaning and all have a purpose that you're not going to understand from where you're at now. So live your life, Joel, as much as you can, go as far as you can, and endure as much as you can, because you are working things out that are connected to a greater good that you won't understand from where you're at now.
Well, with that perspective, he would have realized that he made an error. Or is that not right?
Well, that's not right, because one of the things he said to me at that time was that it was his path and his destiny to take his life at that time. And he didn't acknowledge that he made an error. But that was the most...
That's important, because a lot of us don't understand the nature of life after life with regard to suicide and other things like it.
Well, we have different opinions on that. I mean, plenty of people have told me that, you know, they go straight to hell, and I've heard all different opinions on that. I personally believe that they don't, and you know, this was my experiences.
Well, I personally believe that we don't have a vengeful God, you know, a really angry God, and that if you take your own life, he punishes you for that by sending you to hell or even something in between. I just, you know, particularly in a case of somebody who has a fatal disease, and no, to me, God is not like that, but you know, it's just an opinion.
Well, that contact that night gave me the hope and the courage to go on living and to live through some opportunistic infections that were 80%, 90% fatal at the time. So, you know, that was a very powerful experience that evening, and it's not one that's documentatable. It's not one that happened with someone else there. And it's not one that was well witnessed, and it would be very easy to chalk it up to grieving. But I can tell you, it wasn't.
Well, and taken with all the rest of it, too. Why are you, how are you still alive today?
Great question. Very, very, very good question. I'll tell you, I don't believe, Art, that any disease in the history of mankind has ever been 100% fatal. I mean, there have been people that have come out of the Ebola comas and lived. And I think that part of surviving and part of my surviving is achieving a state of forgiveness, being able to let go of things, reduce stress, strong inner will to live. I believe that this book is my purpose. I think I'm here to serve people with this book. And I think a lot of it is miraculous.
Well, at some point, yeah, but that changed. In other words, at the point when you went down to Mexico and got the stuff for suicide, with
I was ready to go.
You obviously had a different mental state.
Right.
So
it changed with these experiences. It changed. I mean, if you lived, you have to understand, if you lived through your best friend or your partner dying and coming to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, telling you that there's a note in the trash and you find the note,
right.
no matter how skeptical you are, that happens to you, you're going to live a different life after that, because you're going to have knowledge that there really is something after this, and that there's meaning and there's purpose in all of these moments of life. It's a tremendous experience for me, and I can only go solo, no matter what happens to me in life.
Well, having come from the background you've come from, you know, being an atheist, where have you come from? In other words, you no longer are exactly an atheist. Do you believe in the traditional God of the Bible now, as written? Have you made a conversion? Are you simply somewhere in between now, or what?
I have a different sense of God. In my description of God, I can tell you in a very simple, quick analogy. I saw a very famous rabbi and a cardinal one time debating the nature of God. And at the end of the wrap-up, the rabbi says to the cardinal, "Look, let's just cut through to the chase. For 2,000 years, Christians have believed that mankind is intrinsically bad, we inherit original sin, and we have to go to Jesus, we have to go to God for forgiveness, God being an outside source. For 4,000 years, Jews have believed that mankind is intrinsically good. When we mess up, we go to God for forgiveness."
Mm-hmm.
My personal philosophy after living through these experiences is that God's not an outside source, that we are all a grain of sand. Collectively, we make up a beach. The beach is God, and it's the responsibility of each of us to shine our own grain of sand so the beach is as beautiful as it can be. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's the way that I feel about it.
Does that philosophy include, you know, a grain of sand and a greater consciousness? All sounds like a collective thing, but the messages you got were individual and specific and not from a collective. Do you think there's a period of time when the individual is not yet part of the collective, when individual action of the kind that began when Albert died can occur?
Wait, are you asking me if the individual is part of the collective?
Well,
not part of the collective after death, or
well,
before
and not
death?
In other words, not immediately part of the collective.
I tend to believe that we're all connected, even in this life, even though we're in separate containers and separate vessels. I think we all, in some way that maybe we can't fathom, we all are all collective. We all influence this thing. We are.
All right, I'll try and sharpen that question
okay.
when we get back. Stay right there. I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
Really wanna see you, Lord, but it takes
listening to Ark Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
Well, this is interesting. I guess not totally unexpected. Here's a fax that just came in the last hour. It simply says, please get the fag off the air. He can have his time on the radio in hell. And with all due respect, screw you. We're going to do exactly what we want to do here. And this gentleman is here with a poignant and important story. If you don't care about your afterlife, that's your business. And if you carry a prejudice of this kind, in my opinion, you better be worried about your afterlife. All right, I'm trying to pursue a path to the truth, which is what I told Joel before the broadcast. He said, what are you looking for? I said, the truth. Looking for the truth. And there are various ways of looking for the truth. One is with the kind of forensic evidence that I've got up on the website tonight. You might take a look. There is an image on this man's, on the front of his jacket that you've got to see. It's one of those classic photographs. I would suggest you take a look at my website at www.artbell.com. The other is life after life. It's probably the biggest question that man faces. Because without something after this life, then what are the motions that we are going through? What do they mean? And toward the end of the hour, I was asking about the collective versus the individual. And Joel, you're back on the air again. Here's what I mean. It seems as though ghosts, if you want to call them that, for lack of a better name, or spirits departed, are able to be in, you know, rather direct contact many times, in the way contact was apparently made with you, but then at some point pass into another realm, or the contact ceases for whatever reason. That's why I said, I wonder if there's a period of time where that kind of contact is possible, probable, whatever, and then something changes in the afterlife.
I'm not sure. I have to tell you a little story that's the flip side to that fax that came through.
Sure.
The flip side in all of this, and that's a really good question. I do have a philosophy, on your question and what happens afterwards, and I'm sort of putting those pieces together in my mind. But more important is the fact that is there something there? Mm. And the flip side to the negative stuff is that I get a lot of people coming forward to me and telling me their own stories. I'm at a book signing recently. A guy comes up to me. His wife had been killed by a drunk driver 5 years ago. He's got a 6.5-year-old little girl, and his father's alive. No one else was alive in his family except for his father. His mother had died, and her parents were dead. Anyway, the father has lung cancer and is in the hospital, expected to live for another year and a half, goes to the hospital. This is about a month before my book signing, and the father dies. And he's dreading going home to his 6-year-old daughter, and how is he going to tell the daughter, who's at 6 years old, had this much loss, that now grandpa is gone, right? Mm-hmm. Dreading seeing her face. Walks into the house, she runs up to him with a huge smile, grabs him and says, Daddy, grandpa came to me. Grandpa came to visit me today. He told me he's not going to be around for a real long time. I'm not going to see him for a long time. He's going to be with grandma. Mm-hmm. The guy tells me that story. It's very, very close to the things that have happened to me. This guy was also very skeptical. But, you know, the 6-year-old girl had no way of knowing that the grandfather had died.
Of course not. So, you know, you heard about the Alaska Airlines Flight 261 going down, right?
You heard about the ring on that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that.
That's what I was about to say.
Absolutely.
It seems so unlikely. This woman...
Exact same thing.
Lost, I think it was her husband?
It was her father.
Father, I'm sorry, her father.
Yeah, and they had made the pact that whoever died first would try to signal the other one that it's okay on the other side.
Yeah, this is LA Times article. And sure enough, you know what happened? They brought up a Mason's ring.
Right. It's the father's ring.
That belong. Yeah. Now, that's so incredibly unlikely.
Right.
They had made a pact, just like we're talking about right now. This is in today's news.
Exactly.
And there is the signal. Now, how likely is it that of all the things they bring up would be a Mason's ring, which would not float, obviously.
Right. No, and these are the things that happened to me. And that's the nice thing about my book, Signals, is that forget about all the hatred and the crap, like that fact. I'm getting people coming forward and telling me that they were embarrassed to tell these stories. This guy at the book signing said he never told anyone the story. He did, and it's amazing how many people. I'm getting 20, 30 emails a day, people telling me similar things that have happened.
Are you willing to accept email? I guess I better ask you that.
Oh, yeah.
What is your email address?
It's abookforall@AOL.
A book for all?
Number four, a book for all.
Oh, the number four, okay.
Yeah, at AOL. Or joelrothschild.com. I have a website.
Okay, a book, the number four, all@AOL.com.
Right.
Okay.
There's also another one, one good book at AOL also.
One good book?
Yeah, O-N-E, one good book.
Okay, actually you spell it out there.
Yeah, that's easier.
All right.
But
all right, you said you had begun to form some opinions yourself on the nature of the chronology of how it might happen.
Well, okay, now we're going down a road with less documentation.
Understood.
And less evidence. And I will tell you that when Albert came to me, it did not feel like he was alone. And I have to tell you that I had other friends die that year. My three other best friends all died that year. I had no signals from them, no contact, nothing.
But you also had not made a pact with them.
No, that's true. But I still kind of hoped that I would see them or have some sort of contact. My feeling was that when he was with me, he wasn't alone, that there were other spirits with him. Mm. And I do think that when this... since this has happened, I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I've read a lot of spiritual books. I get a feeling, what I'm getting a sense of, is that after the soul leaves the body, there's a period, very briefly, and I've had this debate with a lot of people, if people disagree with me, that the soul leaves the body, is alone, and then joins the collective numbers of souls.
Right.
But even when it joins that collective number of souls, can still signal, because I really believe that when Albert was with me, there were other when Albert came to me, there were other souls with him. But I don't know if it matters. You know, I think what really matters ultimately is to have faith that there is something after this. And I think that we, at least in some of us, it will instill a better consciousness and a better style of living, you know, taking care of
yourself. Yeah, we do all of that. Well, it's always been said that religion, you know, is the taskmaster that keeps everybody in line. The threat of, you know, the threat of hell and the threat of, you know, all the things standard religion talks about, or even many religions, actually, for that matter, to keep people socially in line. But, if there is an afterlife, it certainly is going to keep people, to some degree, in line, I would think. Do you believe in reincarnation?
What a good question. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Part of me does and part of me doesn't. And I don't know if I'm going to have these answers until afterwards.
It doesn't seem like one life is enough time to work it all off.
No.
You know, that's what it's based on, of course, that you keep coming back until you get it to some degree right. And one life doesn't seem like a long enough time to do that.
There's a great book. There was an MD, Brian Weiss. Do you know Brian Weiss?
I do.
And he wrote a book that sort of gives... He's an MD, and he wrote a book about reincarnation. Gives as accurate documentation, I think, as an evidence of reincarnation as you could probably give. Many lives, many masters. But I don't know. And I don't know. For me, I don't know if it's important to know. What was important in all of this, for me, at the very core of this, is the realization that all of life matters. That the good, the bad, the happy, the sad, when you're suffering, you're still working things out. I mean, we all want to be happy. We all want to have good health. But that there's meaning and purpose even in those periods that don't feel so good. I don't know if that makes sense.
My wife years ago, and I know my audience may have heard this several times from me, she told me something. I always thought, you know, if I had a fatal disease of any kind that was going to be a very painful, prolonged death, then I would seek that out. You know, read Final Exit, go to Mexico, get whatever you need, and check out, rather than going through a long, painful death. And my wife told me that, no, she said, you're supposed to play out the hand you're dealt. And I don't know if that's true or not. I've given it a lot of thought, and I think now more than not, it's probably true. You're supposed to play out the hand you're dealt, because your friend took his own life before he was even ill. You were ill at the time. You're playing out your hand. I don't know. On the other hand, maybe it was his hand to take his life, but it seems an unsatisfactory conclusion.
Well, I think you all have to, you have to go with what you know at the time. I mean, I got the drugs. I had decided that I would do it, you know, up until 1994, 95, I was ready to take my own life to not have to suffer. My feeling now is, after going through these experiences, that those moments of suffering serve some sort of purpose that I can't understand.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's changed for me.
Well, maybe some are meant or supposed to go through that, and maybe others are not,
mm-hmm.
or are not prepared for it in this life.
Well, I think we all suffer. I think everybody, every human being suffers. I don't think we suffer equally, but I think we all suffer. And, you know, maybe there is a, maybe suffering functions, if we're all collected, we're all connected in a collective body of God, perhaps suffering is like the liver in a body, you know, it cleanses. I don't understand the meaning and the purpose in suffering, but one of the things that Albert said to me the night that he died was that there is meaning and purpose in the suffering. And it's something that I profoundly believe. And, you know, it was one of the biggest changes throughout this.
There's meaning in the suffering.
Meaning and purpose.
Purpose in the suffering.
In every moment of life. And I don't think we're going to know it. I don't think we're going to know it from this plane of existence. I think we're grappling to know that there's something after this. And I think my book offers good documentation.
You know, that's not the message I would have expected from him. I mean, he took his own life. So the message I would have expected, or I would have expected, let's put it this way, your mind to generate, would have been one that justified his death. But that statement doesn't necessarily justify his death at all, to suggest that every moment of life, good, bad, or ugly, is precious and important.
Well, maybe he was telling me and giving me hope to go forward, because at that time I was suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he was trying to instill in me is a sense of hope that there was a meaning and there was a purpose in this. And if I could have experienced that knowing from someone departed who I shared this great friendship and this great love with, I would have that seed of hope in my heart. And, you know, hope is an amazing thing. I mean, ultimately, you asked me earlier, how am I still here? I have to say that a big chunk of it is hope.
Hope and improved medicines, no doubt, but I mean you...
At this point, yes.
You really should not have made it this far.
I shouldn't be here. All right, I've gone through four bouts of pneumocystis pneumonia before there was treatment for it. And though that was, at that time, you know, a fatal infection. So I shouldn't be here.
How close did you get to taking your own life? How close did you actually get?
Ready. Completely ready. I have the drugs in the house. I was ready to mix them up and ready to go. And that little seed of hope that I got from Albert that night is what kept me going. And I was tremendously ill at that time. And I was frail and thin and taking care of three other friends that were dying. It was a tremendous challenge. But that experience was the seed of hope that's kept me alive. And now I'm in great shape, in great health.
You're taking the new protease inhibitors and all the new drugs they have, I take it?
Well, I've been on them since they weren't, you know, in study.
Experimental.
Right. because I'm such an old timer at this. But
What is your prognosis now, by the way? The doctors who gave you not very long to live so long ago, what do they say now?
They don't know. You know, the immune system, they're discovering now that the immune system does bounce back. But the longer, the quicker, see, there's not a lot of people like me left, so they really don't know. What they're finding now is that people that seroconvert or come down with AIDS now, that get on the medicine, the immune system really bounces back very quickly. They can get the virus to a level of undetectable in the system, and their system bounces back. But what they found with me is that it won't bounce back to anywhere near a normal level. So I'm functioning as an AIDS patient, but a healthy AIDS patient. Does that make sense?
That's not killing you.
What?
It's not killing you.
No, it's not killing me, and I haven't had a serious opportunistic infection in a number of years. So obviously there's a big shift, and I think I represent that shift.
Well, then maybe Albert's message was specifically for you. Maybe he was looking down a timeline and saw that you could live a productive life.
Bingo.
And so, hence the words.
You got it. And there you have it. It wasn't meant to be a book, and it wasn't meant for other people. These messages and these signals were really specific to me. In the way that it came into being into a book, into sharing this, is that things would happen with friends, like a hummingbird landing on me, and friends said, you got to write this. Everybody said, you got to write this. So, of course, this is a very personal experience. It wasn't meant to be shared. It wasn't meant for a radio show or a television show.
I got you.
Yeah, and that's how the book came into being, is just that so many things happened where there were witnesses.
All right. Hold it right there, and we'll be right back. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Good morning. What do you believe?
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight, featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
Only me.
Premier Radio Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired February 8th, 2000.
Joel's book is called Signals. Simply Signals. And we are going to open the phone lines here in a moment, and it should be interesting to see how it goes. I'm getting more faxes. I'll catch you up on some of them in a moment. All right. Once again, my guest, and we are about to go to the phones here. So if you have a question, I can imagine you might. You're more than welcome to ask it. This is kind of interesting, something I want to cover with you, Joel. It says, Art, your homosexual guest on the air is experiencing a series of demonic visits. The entity appearing and or communicating with him is a personifier of his dead gay friend. Demons have been known to do that. Now, that's really interesting because I've noticed that when a Christian dies and a relative is left behind and there's a signal or a voice, it's because of God. But because you're homosexual and your friend was, it's going to be a demon, according to this faxer. Interesting twist.
Well, my answer to that is that ever since this happened, I've been the best Joel that I could ever be and the kindest and done more good than I've ever done in my life. So is that what demons cause you to do?
Mm-hmm. And then there's this, and you might give an answer. After considering the question, Art, for about 40 of my 50 years, I've decided there are only two possibilities. One, once someone stays dead for an extended period, there is no way to return, no matter how badly the person wants to return or send a message. Two, the afterlife is so incredibly wonderful of an experience or existence that once we have passed over, we have no need or desire to ever return. I subscribe to the second option, it says. Neil at Topaz Ranch, Nevada. In other words...
Got it. Great point. What if there's a great love?
Yeah.
Really beautiful friendship, a really beautiful love between two people.
Then...
And there was a desire to signal. Out of that loyalty. Out of that friendship. I think he has a great point. But in my particular case, there was a friendship like brothers, better than brothers. I mean, just best friends.
Well, that must have been a rather interesting conversation when you... Although, you know something? During the break, I went in, my wife said, if I go first, do you want me to try to signal you? And I thought about it, and I said, yes. What kind of conversation did you have with Albert?
What kind of conversation?
Yeah, what kind of deal?
About the signaling?
Yeah, that's right.
Before he died?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That was a good point. It was during a card game with a group of friends that had AIDS. He brought up the idea and he said, why don't... He posed it to the whole gang, everybody in the card game. And everyone in the game pretty much laughed at the idea and scoffed at it and thought it was a silly thing. And since I respected him so much and I cared about him, I almost was patronizing as I went along with it. I kind of jokingly said, Albert, if I go first, and I'll probably be the one that goes first, I'll signal you. I'll flicker a light in your room. And then over the course of the following year, we talked about it 20, 30 times. He kept saying to me, well, if you go first, you're going to signal me, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I'll flick a light in your room. I'll try something. And he goes, well, I promise you, with my heart and soul, that I'll signal you if I can. And we talked about it, 20, 30 times. But it was more it was totally his idea. And I kind of was patronizing, going along with it. I didn't want to say, how can you say no to somebody's hope?
Well, while a lot of people in my audience I know don't agree with your lifestyle, yeah. It is my view, Joel, that love is the strongest binding force in the universe. Period. Strongest binding force. You agree with that?
100%. Absolutely.
All right, let's see what's out there. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Good evening, Art. It's William from Portland.
Hi there.
Hello, Joel. Very quickly, I'd like to recount to you, Joel, my own experiences, which are very similar to yours. My brother passed on with AIDS in 95, and we were always best friends. I was with him all through till the end. I was holding his hand as he went. And as when I returned home that day, he came to me, and I saw him clearly. He said, "Greg, I made it." And then he turned literally to stars and was gone. Now, I felt his presence for about 6 months, and we had incredible strokes of luck. We won a couple of lotteries and contests and things. And then suddenly one day, it was as if he was literally gone. I did not feel his presence anymore. And to support what you said about suffering, he had a life with many personal demons, and he also had the suicide drugs. At the end, he did not take them, though. He suffered terribly. And in the last 3 days of his life, there was this glow that developed about him, and I felt that he did much of his life's work and his processing of these demons out, and he came to peace with himself. And I know that he died a very happy person, so I support your decision and what you've done also, and I just wanted to relay that story to you. And
well, I appreciate that, and I have to add to what I didn't say is, in the years after Albert's death also, I had the best luck.
Really?
Yeah, everything went my way, and it had never been that way in life before.
The same for me. I won a contest for about $1,000, and I found a camera I hadn't had for years. It was amazing.
I mean, I had great luck that 18-month period, just the best. I could do no wrong.
So he was with you for a year and a half?
Yeah, no one has ever shared that with me before, that they had good luck after someone passed.
And well, we were both very good friends, and I miss him terribly. I just wanted to relay that to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Take care. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Hello, Art. This is Mark in Indianapolis.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. Joel, how are you?
I'm okay.
I'm the guy who just sent you the life after death photographs on the email.
Okay.
Yeah. My best friend Jim also died of AIDS, and we made a pact that he would give me a signal once he made it to the other side. And, Art, one of the photos that I sent to Joel, my friend Jim died on the 8th of September, 94. Mm-hmm. My next-door neighbor was taking a photograph of the moon with a flash camera exactly 1 year to the day after Jim's death. Jim showed up in the photograph. This has happened so many times in my life. My loved ones who have died have kind of barged their way into photographs. What I have found as time goes along, for those who are interested in contacting people or being contacted, it calls for a change in perspective. And this is the change. We tend to think of ourselves as being visited by them, like they peek through our windows, like they come into our world. That's not true. We are right now living in their world. Once you let that change in perspective take over in your life, you will be more open to it, and you'll be amazed at the things that are going to happen to you in terms of getting contacts from the other side.
That's an interesting, that is an interesting perspective. Have you yet, Joel, seen The Sixth Sense?
Yeah, I did see it.
It makes you wonder if there's, we talk about the other side like it's far away. Maybe it isn't far away at all. Maybe it's all happening at once, and it's all around us. That's what the man just said, and that reminded me of The Sixth Sense.
And that's, certainly a lot of people believe that. And I defer to my standard answer. I don't know, is it important to know, Art? Is that
I don't know.
What was important for me is to know that there was something there.
Yeah, I think it's important to me too. I want to know, and I think it's the biggest question that all men and all women face. Period. It's that simple.
Now, before these experiences happened to me, a caller like that would have called on a show, and I would have said that he was full of it. I would never have even believed him. And having lived through it firsthand, I think, yeah, it's amazing it's happening to other people. So, it's changed me, and hopefully the book changes other people and opens the door to them having their own experiences.
I remember the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, because I was on the air, Joel, and I remember all the people who said, it's God's wrath on the homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a few total nutcases out there saying that today, but not so much anymore. Then they did. It was God's wrath on the homosexuals. How'd you get through that period?
Boy, that was really tough, Art. That was really, really tough. It's difficult for so many people, so much hatred. You know, there's that preacher somewhere, I think in Oklahoma, that protests at AIDS funerals.
Oh, yes, he goes to funerals, yeah.
Yeah, it's always tough to deal with hate. I mean, it hurts, and it's incredibly difficult.
Well, hate of your fellow man, that's one thing, and it's hard enough. But to be suggesting that the Creator, the God, would bring this forth on homosexuals, that was predominantly said at that time. That must have been really rough. Maybe not so rough for you. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, the intellectual answer to that is that it's predominantly heterosexuals in Asia. It's predominantly heterosexuals in Africa. And now in this country, it's predominantly heterosexual women that are getting it, women of color.
Oh, I know.
So, you know, the intelligent answer is that, you know, that's obviously not the case.
Yeah.
It's still painful to hear.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Hi, this is a great show. I'm really enjoying it, Art and Joel. I'm David from San Francisco, and very much a heterosexual Christian, but I read the book and loved it.
Oh, you read Signals?
Yeah, there was a big stack of them at Borders, and it's got a great cover, and I picked it up. It's a beautiful read, and I've been telling people stories from it. The stories are so incredible, Joel. I wish you could tell the story of the pregnant woman.
Well,
maybe even the stop the car one. But
you can. Joel, we've got amazing time. Tell the stories.
Okay. I was living in a high-rise building, and this is a tough one, Art. This is like The Sixth Sense, one of those stories. And there was a woman working at the front desk, kind of cold Hispanic woman, never acknowledged me, used to try to be friendly to her every day, and I'm leaving one day, and I could feel Albert say, you've got to give her a message. And I left the building, and I thought, you know, she's going to think I'm insane, and I was going to the library, went to the library, he kept saying, you've got to go back, you've got to give her a message, just go to her and tell her sister's pregnant, and then I'll tell you what to say.
Right.
I went back to the building. I said, Carmen, is your sister pregnant? She looked at me flabbergasted and pissed off. She said, how the hell did you know? Anyway, it turns out that her sister was pregnant, and she was having an affair with somebody, and she was considering an abortion. Anyway, the message from Albert at that time was to tell her not to have the abortion, and that the child was indeed the brother's kid. And
wow.
Yeah, it was a miraculous story. Yeah.
So nobody else knew about that?
No, she was shocked. No one knew. The sister had just confessed.
To the
actually,
other
was her sister-in-law,
yeah,
married to her brother, just had confessed that she was having an affair and thinking about the abortion.
Whew.
So anyway, after that, needless to say, we were very close friends.
Wow, that's an amazing story. And he referenced one other story.
I don't remember which one.
No, I don't either. I heard him say something about, he said the pregnant woman, then he said something else as well. I wish you could tell that story. So there must be a lot of stories in your book.
Well, there was a good year and a half of psychic events and, you know, involving other people as well. Oh, he said the car accident.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, yeah, the car accident. About a year after Albert died, I was in my new building, and a bunch of us went out on a Saturday night, and I'm sober, and so I was the designated driver, and we're on La Cienega and Santa Monica Boulevard, which is a huge intersection, and about 90 feet before the intersection, I heard Albert's voice say, stop the car. So I slammed on the brakes. Everybody practically had whiplash in the car. Anyway, a few cars passed us. Needless to say, there was a huge accident. One of those great big semi trucks hit a car. Somebody was killed at the scene.
Wow!
And that was another one. I had actually forgotten about that story.
Boy, these aren't just signals; they're like telegrams.
Yeah.
Now, I guess from the moment you held his dead body and got that first message, you learned to listen. A lot of us get messages, and we dismiss them as sort of random firings of synapses in our brain, you know.
No, I'm not patronizing you, Art. You are one bright man. Because I'll tell you, you really are. I'm amazed that you got that. Because that's how I learned. If I hadn't gone through that first experience, I would have thought maybe I was paranoid or it was self-talk.
Sure.
You're right. I mean, you're absolutely 100% right. That's how I learned to listen to the message.
You're so fortunate.
I mean, I can't believe that you got that.
So many of us, you know, we want to know, we want to believe, and that's why I have people like you on the radio, because I haven't met that same kind of concrete proof that you have.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I felt it. Mm-hmm. I wish I was as confident.
Well, read the book.
Yeah.
It may give you some. I mean, you know, it's secondhand, but it's pretty close to documentating it.
Do you think that when somebody is open to this, when you have made yourself receptive to these sorts of messages, that they are very much more likely to be received? I guess the answer to that is absolutely yes.
I would assume so, but I don't know. You know, these were thrust upon me. I didn't ask for any of this to happen. I didn't expect any of this. You know, and there's times where I wish, you know, I wish it would happen more. If something goes wrong, I'm wishing I would know, you know, I could hear Albert say what to do. It's just not something that you can turn on and off.
Do you now feel his presence really gone? In other words, from where it was when you would get occasional signals, messages,
yep.
Suddenly gone. I mean, you can feel the vacuum?
Yep, absolutely. And I'm very sad to admit that. And, you know, a lot of friends would probably say, oh, you're wrong, and he could never have left you. But, yeah, it's not the same. It's not the same as it was in 95, you know, when these things were happening. Bang, 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 right after another.
Were there ever moments when you wished that presence that you felt, those voices that you heard, were not happening?
Yes, absolutely. Another on-the-mark question, boy. There was a time when, like that story with the girl that was pregnant, there was a couple other experiences where I had a message similar to the Sixth Sense, someone. And after the experience, I was drained, almost felt physically jet-lagged. And there was a period of a time where I wished it wasn't happening.
Where it was taking your energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, hold on. You good for one more hour?
Sure.
All right, well, the phones are stacked, so we'll do one more hour. I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
In my arms, I know the magic of her charms, 'cause I want girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Somewhere in Time. tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
It is at. Good morning, everybody. My guest is Joel Rothschild. He'll be back in a moment. We're into open lines now with Joel. And this is kind of interesting, aren't I? I recently read Joel's book, Signals. Apparently a lot of people have. And what's amazing about the book is that it transcends sexuality and the fact that it was written by a gay man. The book is for everyone. Joel hasn't said much this evening about his psychic experiences since Albert's death, but for me, it was like reading those accounts of the psychic experiences in the book that have made me realize how much more there is than just the tangible things that we can see or hear. His book is one of the most significant things I've ever read. This is interesting. By the way, he says, when I was trying to find time to read Signals, which I really needed spiritually at the time, there was a hummingbird outside my window for a long time, and it stayed there until I finally sat down and read the book. The following is from Gail in Las Vegas, and Gail says, "Aren't you know, before Albert's suicide, Joel had no faith in God, no hope of any kind. What a wonderful gift Albert left behind. It doesn't sound like he was escaping. It sounds like he was lighting the way." That'll be interesting.
Beautiful point.
To the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Hi, this is Jeremy in Burlington, Vermont.
Hello, Jeremy. How are you doing?
Pretty good. About a year and a half ago or so, I discovered that I actually had this somewhat of a psychic ability. Pretty much a friend told me, you know, you got to listen to these signals, pretty much like what your guest was saying. And I was wondering, now, since I have these, I can pick up on these things, would I actually be able to communicate with somebody who's already passed away, or is that along the same lines as that? I'm relatively new to this.
Asking me?
Yeah, I guess he is.
I don't know. I mean...
You know, because from what you describe it as...
There are people, and I've had several of them on the show, nationally famous...
Mediums,
yeah, who are able to communicate with somebody who has passed away. Now, that seems different than what happened to you, Joel. Yours was specific.
Well, I had some mediumistic experiences.
Did you?
Yeah, and that was what the caller earlier was saying with this girl that, you know, the sister was going to have the abortion. And the only thing is, I've never been able to turn them on or off.
I understand that. I've had a couple in my life, and I couldn't control them starting, and I couldn't control them stopping. And I even tried to bring them on purpose and couldn't. It was a total waste of effort. But when they came to me, they were so strong that they could not be ignored. The comparison I made with the experience I had was, it was like ocean waves washing over me, compelling me to go and do something, which I ultimately finally did, which was silly. I don't really want to tell this whole story again, but someone...
You had a signal. There you go, Art. Had one.
It was a signal.
You had one. There you had it. That sounds just about what it felt like to me.
Yeah. It was so compelling that you could not possibly ignore it. And that's the way it was for me, but it only happened once. Wild card line, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Jim in Byron Center, Michigan.
Yes, Jim.
And, well, first I want to make a quick comment to you. You had the show on with the anti-aging thing the other night.
That's right.
I thought you missed the perfect opportunity for a bumper song by Queen, Who Wants to Live Forever. I waited for it all night. And didn't
well, you're right. I got 25 in there, but I didn't get that. You can't do it all.
No. Well, my question for him, Joel, is the process or what he's going through right now, is it healthy for his grieving process, or is it extending maybe the grieving for this person? I know I'm married to my soulmate, and we've made kind of a similar pact, and I've been concerned, you know, that maybe it'll extend the pain rather than let it just go.
Yeah, that's really... Oh, boy, is that a good point.
Well, I'm way past the grieving period myself, and what a clinical social worker said to me, who called me on another show, is that in some cases, these type experiences are written off to grieving, to people's grief.
Sure.
Hallucination.
Sure.
the bulk of my experiences happened a year after Albert was already dead, and I was already past my grieving. So this caller said that that was incredibly unusual. But what I will say is that none of this protracted a grieving period. If anything, it helped. I mean, it gave me hope.
Yeah, but you were mentally set for it. I mean, at the moment you were holding his dead body,
uh-huh.
and you got that message, from that moment on, you would be unlikely to ignore any other message you would get, I would think.
Yeah, I still was. I was in a cloud. I mean, you know, you go through death, you're holding, a dead body. I was wrecked. I had lost my best friend, so I was grieving then, and I didn't give that whole situation a lot of thought. I for years I looked back and analyzed hopping that wall and getting that note, and I thought about it time and time again. But at that point in time, I didn't think about it. It just, I just was reacting. And that night that he came to me, I was just, it planted a seed of hope. I didn't digest it for years. I didn't
fully when you say he came to you,
mm-hmm.
do you mean you were mentally aware of his presence? Do you mean you saw something? Do you mean
there was a physical light in the room? There was a light, very translucent light. You know what dust looks like coming through a stream of sunlight in a window?
Sure, sure.
Or smoke above
smoke.
A candle?
I know about smoke, yeah.
There was a little bit of veiled light in the room above me.
And so all of a sudden, the dust or whatever it was, particulate matter in the air, was illuminated.
Right. And Albert's presence was there, and he said, "You know it's me, don't you?" And I was frozen, completely frozen.
With terror?
No. I had some fear. Another good question. I had some fear for a few seconds. Or I don't know what time frame this whole thing transpired, but initially I had a sense of fear, but as I realized he was there, it was very calm, but I was just frozen. I couldn't move. I was just completely immobile.
I've got you. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Oh, good morning, Eric.
Good morning. You're going to have to yell at us a little. You're not too loud. Where are you?
Okay, I'm sorry. This is Chris in Seminole, Florida.
Okay, Seminole, Florida. All right, go ahead, Chris.
Well, first, you're very fortunate, it just crossed my mind to say, to have seen... seeing your lover's light after you've died, or after he's died. In any case, I want to preface what I wanted to say here with, that we need to understand the mechanics of how creation works. And I know you said there's some things that it's not important to know. Well, sometimes it is, but not right now. I wanted to remark about my brother who committed suicide about 10 years ago.
Yes.
And apparently he felt obligated to signal back. My mother and I especially, and other members of my family, saw lights, a sequence of lights of different colors going through different periods of time. And because the dead apparently can see into the future, we found the Bardolph et al. Later on. And it says, the Tibetan Book of the Dead that Joel mentioned that he read earlier. And by the way, that means after-death hearing, which implies the need to listen after you're dead. To progress spiritually. But in any case, we found that the sequence of lights that we saw matched exactly the phases in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead also says that I believe this to be true, that during the first 7 days or days, not literal days, but the days after death, that we go through meeting relatives and having a good time is basically having what we want, being able to create what we want. And mm-hmm. then we go through, it transits into a period of 7 days of meeting our conscience, which are in the form of wrathful and terrifying deities, they call them, or demons or whatever. And it's important, the Tibetan Book of the Dead says, and I feel this to be true, to tell the dead to bless these and to recognize that they're reflections of our own soul as soon as possible after death. And that's the whole purpose of the book is to coach the dead into the light, so to speak. And I just wanted to make the point, and Joel can respond to this, that fine, communicate telepathically with your dead, but I just don't think it's good to ask for the deceased to expend any extra energy, you know, for any special things. And
what about making a pact though prior to death?
That's a good point, and that's I believe, you know, we do want to move on after death, but yet that pact was so ingrained in Albert's conscience that yes, it's good that, you know, he gave it energy. He gave energy to that commitment long before he died.
Mm-hmm.
Is my belief.
All right. Thank you very much.
Art, you may have a point that about asking for special favors and asking for things. You know, I hear what he's saying, and it sounds valid to me. I don't ask for special favors. I don't ask for things. I didn't ask for any of these.
You actually, despite your illness, you've prospered fairly well, haven't you? Your success in business.
I've been very successful. I've been very blessed.
Was it true prior to your illness, as well as after your illness and after the death of your friend?
I've always done well, and I've had a fairly successful life. But after Albert's death, it was tenfold. There's no comparison. I couldn't do anything wrong.
Hmm.
You know, I bought a piece of property, it doubled in value.
Yeah.
I mean, I was always at the right place at the right time. And I wasn't asking for it, you know. What reminded me of it is that other caller that said that he won the lottery afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you know. It was the easiest time of my life, those years afterwards, especially economically.
That's really interesting. That's really interesting. And yet so many people not only ask for it, but beg for it and pray for it and never get it. And yet there it was for you.
It was handed to me.
I know. I hear you.
And I don't know, you know, maybe that's just the fate that was the timing of my life and that's the way it unfolded. I don't think so, but it was almost like he was in a corner pulling for me. You know, maybe whispering in my ear signals that I couldn't hear. Go there and buy that house. Go there and do that.
Have you done any research on NDEs, near death, and all the rest of that?
I read Ray Moody's book, mm-hmm. Life After Life, and I did a chat with Peggy Guggenheim. Do you know who she is?
Yes.
Does some research there, but no, I've never done anything. And I've never been included in anybody's studies or anything like that.
All right. And Albert, did Albert ever relate to you in any way? Where he was and what he felt. Did he ever do anything like that?
Good. Another good question. No, but I had a sense, and there wasn't a specific thing said. I had a sense that that one night that he was at peace and that he wasn't alone. But no, not at all.
A lot of people feel that God, as such, doesn't render up some judgment, you know, after you die and you go on to whatever is next, that in effect, you judge yourself. And probably, if you really think about it, if you really were forced to look at the mirror of your life as it really was, not as you have glossed over it or conveniently forgotten it, then you would be a very harsh judge of yourself indeed. Seem logical to you?
Yep, absolutely.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
My name is James.
James, I can barely hear you. Where are you?
Orange County, California.
Okay, yell at us.
All righty. I'm just wondering, after a similar pact, okay, Harry Houdini's wife tried to make contact.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering why she did not receive similar results.
I don't know if she did or she didn't. I've never met her. I mean, I don't know. I had heard about that pact, and people say that they never had contact. I don't know.
Maybe, caller, it has to do with the fact that that pact was only for the purpose of trying to prove there was an afterlife, as opposed to trying to send a signal to somebody you loved.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question, and I imagine that there must be other people that made similar pacts that didn't have this experience. All I can think of is, wow, I was really blessed. I mean, how amazing is it then? It's even more amazing.
All right, caller?
Okay, thank you very much.
Right, thank you. First time caller line, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Hi, this is Dan from Long Beach.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if it would be a normal pattern when someone passes away that, you know, good things should happen to the person's family and friends.
Did it happen to you?
That's kind of hard for me to say, though, because I know there's one woman who passed away from having cancer, and the only regret that I have is I'd never really gotten to know her. And so I can't really answer that. But I was just wondering, you know, for any close friends or family, if any good things would happen afterwards.
Well, the only time I ever heard of anything like that was tonight on your show, Art, the guy that called and said that. The first time I've ever heard of anything like that.
Well, where there's one, there'll be more.
Yeah. And in my particular case, yes, that was the case.
All right, caller?
It was amazing.
All right, back to later, Art.
All right, take care. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Evening.
You're on the air. Turn your radio off, please.
Okay, my radio's off.
Okay, go right. Go ahead.
Good morning, Art.
Morning.
This is Steve in Pikeville, Tennessee.
Yes, sir.
I had a dream. I had them when I was younger about my grandfather. When we were children, we were really close. And when he passed away, I had dreams that he would come to me and ask me if I wanted to go to heaven with him. And then, and of course, I'd say yes, and he would come and, you know, he'd take my hand and we'd walk into this light and we'd go into heaven. And I'm just wondering if this is sort of the same thing because of the close bond that we had when I was a child.
Well, I'd say yes, wouldn't you?
I would, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, we're off into, I don't know, caller. You experienced it. You tell us. I think we lost him.
That sounds like it to me. I mean, I think the one thing that's happened to me, and two things have happened, Art. I got the hate mail, and I got the name calling, and the other thing I got is the stories about people experiencing similar things and different things in their own way, and that's an example.
Exactly.
It's been a catalyst for a lot of people writing me letters and sharing stories that are fairly miraculous that I never would have believed until I lived through it firsthand.
What do you think you're going to get as a result of tonight's program? You think you're going to get a lot of hate mail?
I got a feeling I'll get 50-50.
Hmm.
You know, I think there's a lot of great people out there, a lot of really good, kind people, and I think that there's a lot of people with a lot of hate out there, too. Probably go both ways.
Hold on, Joel. We'll be right back. It probably will go both ways. And one would hope that as the world's consciousness hopefully is raised a little bit, the ratio would begin to change. That would be one sign.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
Tell
just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well. In a castle dark or a fortress strong, with chains upon my feet, you know that ghost is me.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2000.
Oh, you got to think about those words. I'll never be set free as long as I'm a ghost you can see. I wonder if we hold, in effect, spirits here. Certainly is worth considering. And when we no longer hold them and bind them with our minds and our thoughts and our love, then they go. I don't know. Something to think about. All right. Well, here's what brought that on and reminded me of that song. Hi, Art. Life after life. My white cat, Bobby, died. Bobby had a twig of hair always sticking straight up on her head. After she died, my cat, Bunky, had the same twig of hair. Now Bunky has died. Yet she still walks through my house, and I sometimes wonder if our love holds the spirit here when maybe it needs to move on. Joel?
Wow, I don't know what to say to something like that.
But I mean, it almost goes to the sixth sense, and I don't want to give that away because a lot of people have yet to crash into that movie, or the movie crash into them, but that is kind of what it was about there.
Well, in my case, I would want to hold on to Albert if I could, now more than ever. I mean, or as much as ever, and things haven't happened. So, I don't know. I don't think we're that powerful.
Yeah, that's a good point. First time caller line, you're on the air with Joel Rothchild. Hi.
Hello.
Again, I can barely hear you too, dear, so you're going to have to yell at us.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, this is Gemma from Portland, and I don't really listen to this show that often, but I have pretty much every night for a week and a half.
A week and a half, huh?
A week and a half, every night. I stay up pretty late. But I wanted to relate a story about the Celtics. I've never talked on the radio, so this is a little different for me.
New for you.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. I don't want this to sound silly or flighty or anything, but I had a cat whose name was Kitten Fuzzy Paw, and I loved him a lot. Of course, he loved me. He was my kitty cat, and he was at my mom's house. I had just moved to Oregon from San Francisco, and he was at my mom's house, and I was moving into a house, a whole new town, where I didn't know anyone. And I had met a few people, and I met this person, this guy, who was in my life, and but I'd only just met him. I'm kind of embarrassed. Anyhow, he was at my mom's house, and I had had a dream. I was asleep. I had had this dream that I was holding Kitten Fuzzy Paw and rubbing his stomach, like I always did, and he was introducing me to this guy, Trace, okay? And then I woke up from the dream, and I sleep on my stomach, and I woke up on my stomach, and it was sunrise, and it was like an early summer morning, and I could see the brick wall outside of my window, and I could hear birds chirping and whatever, but I had this really pleasant feeling all over. And then about 10 minutes later, I started dozing off again, and my mom called me, and she had called just to say that about 20 minutes earlier, she had let Kitten Fuzzy Paw out to run around, and he got hit by a car and was killed. And that was like right when I was dreaming the dream. And then this person that I had met, I'm not going to say his name, but he was in my life for 5.5 years, and it was a pretty intense love. And I just, I don't know. I've always wanted to tell people that, and I tell people that, but
I know.
It sounds silly. Your cat?
No, it doesn't sound silly.
Well, see, that's the reluctant sensibility, not wanting to tell. I mean, I still have it. I mean, here I have this book out, and it's still difficult to share these stories at times.
No, I have this definite feeling that while I'm still searching for evidence of life beyond, I have this feeling that love is such a bindingly, incredibly strong force that if anything can pierce the veil, that is what does it. And that is what does it. I mean, you could listen to these stories, whether it's a cat or a prison or a loved one, somebody desperately loved, you could hear these stories all day long. And a lot of them cannot be attributed, just like the beginning of your story, to some sort of random protection of the brain, grief exhibiting itself in your brain. That's not what I would call your stories and a lot of the other ones I've heard. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, Art, and hi, Joel. I've got one comment, well, actually two. First of all, Joel, that idiot who called and said the demons were visiting you, I don't think the devil would send anything that would produce you closer to God would come from the devil, would only come from God. Actually, that's probably the purpose. On suffering, I used to volunteer with children in Dallas that were HIV positive. We had a home for the children. And a lot of times the children, we would go to their hospital and basically on their deathbed, and the children would talk about the light and everything. And I had one child in particular who was only 4 years old who would tell me about the light man who would take away all his hurt because everybody was worried about all the suffering he was going through. And what I found out and through this child, what I learned was suffering, it's like natural disasters. People are drawn together that normally wouldn't be drawn together, and there's this unconditional love that comes around. And sometimes when people are sick and they're suffering, people who would not be drawn together tend to have this unconditional love and surpass the things that we look at here on earth, and their purpose seems to be to draw those people together and to produce an unconditional love. And I know with this child, what's really odd is it's like he's been reincarnated through my nephew. The things that this child did, my nephew does. And then we found out my nephew is terminally ill. Oh, and boy. What's really odd is everybody in my family, nobody would be a genetic match except me to donate a kidney to him, which is really, really odd because the child that I took care of would play with the lights, and he would talk particularly about the light, and so does my nephew. And so it's like this reincarnation, and he doesn't seem to be suffering at all physically. It's just this learning process that he has taught the whole family and everyone else. And I was just wondering if that you have experienced that a lot of people through that suffering have learned unconditional love because of your friend.
Well, you remind me of your story reminds me of my favorite book of all time, and which sort of says the same thing that you said. There was a Holocaust survivor, Viktor Frankl, wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, greatest book I've ever read in my life, and actually my inspiration for putting this thing on paper, because I didn't want to share these stories, even though friends were telling me to share these stories, and his courage in telling his Holocaust story is what encouraged me to do this, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, there's a solidification, there's people coming together, there's lessons to be learned here, lessons about hope, lessons about love. I mean, there's so many lessons that are learned in this suffering. I mean, AIDS, for example, we're all going to die. I mean, we're all dying. And one of the things that AIDS did for me, which was a gift, is stripped away my natural human denial of my own death so that I was able to live in the moment, which was actually a gift.
Yeah, actually, in a way it was, because a lot of people have absolutely no warning of their demise whatsoever. They never get to consider it in life and the meaning of life and the value of life versus what they're facing. They just get they just blink out, you know, instantly. So in a way, knowing or facing your own mortality is a kind of a gift in a way, and it lets you get square with yourself and a lot of other things. So
absolutely.
Yeah, that's all true. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Art. My name is John. I'm calling from Yonkers, New York, listening on 77 WABC.
Hi, John.
Hi. My viewpoint is that of someone who has lost two close family members to cancer. I've wondered why in America today only house pets and convicted serial murderers are given the painless death of chemically induced execution. Until I came across a rather startling statistic, and that is that of the several billion dollars spent every year by Americans for medical services, hospitals, doctors, prescription drugs, fully 70% of all that money is spent on maintaining individuals in the last 60 to 90 days of life. It's a phenomenal amount of money spent to maintain people who are virtually at death's door. And I was curious to know if Joel and his friend Albert's experience with self-euthanasia by choice, if he feels there is any hope for Americans to break this medical deadlock so that people will not have to seek painful death through self-inflicted gunshot wounds or whatever, when they finally reach that point where they can no longer tolerate the pain.
All right. Well, obviously it's a Dr. Death kind of question, and I'm sure that you've mightily considered that for a long time, Joel.
Well, I mean, I personally believe that I wish we had that freedom as they do in a few other countries in the Netherlands. But then spiritually, having gone, and this is going to go, boy, right against what I just said, and I'm someone who got the drugs and planned for my final exit, having gone through these experiences, spiritually, I now believe that I would never do that, that every moment of life matters. And I
wonder if that's a universal truth or an individual truth.
It's my truth, so it's probably individual. And we would take an animal out of pain that we wouldn't take a human being out of.
Yes, we would.
I've seen some horrible deaths from cancer and from AIDS, and protracted and long and very ugly. And I've also seen some deaths where people went a long period of time in their suffering and was in the room with them when they died, and there was this amazing sense of peace and transition.
Have you ever, being with a dying person, and I talk to a lot of people who are with dying people, have you ever actually felt something at the exact moment of transition, at the moment of physical death? Have you ever...
Well, that's a... when is the exact moment is a Kevorkian question.
Yeah, it is, I guess.
A bizarre Kevorkian question. But I can tell you that three friends died, and I was with them when they died. I was in the room. And so I don't know when the exact moment was. I'm not sure of the exact second. I was there... the millisecond, but there was a sense of peace, and there was a sense of peace before that, but there was a stronger sense of peace afterwards.
All right, West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Yeah, how you doing tonight?
Fine.
You guys are having a great show tonight. I really have enjoyed listening to you. I'd just like to say I believe that there's something to the strong bond of love that makes you maybe see something that other people don't see or feel something that other people don't feel. The best thing I can relate it to is my dog Max died of throat cancer. Mm-hmm. And Max was just the greatest dog. I mean, I love him to death. To this day, I just still can't get over his passing away. But every night for about a week, Max would come to the foot of my bed, and he would just sit there, and I would wake up, very peaceful, warm feeling, and I'd look at him, and he would just vanish after a few moments.
Yeah, I know a lot of people scoff at this, but I had a cat that died, and I went through that with my cat. I still do. People who have not experienced it, I'm afraid, are going to be scoffing and scoffing and scoffing, but that's all right. I felt it. I know. I know what you have felt and seen, and it's true. I mean, it's true. Whatever you want to say, it's true. I appreciate it. First time caller line, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
Your book was amazing. I read it, and I gave it to some of my friends to read, and I found it very helpful.
Thank you.
Boy, a lot of your readers are out there. Your book must be... Is it available nationwide now, Joel?
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Is it everywhere? All right.
I've been positive for 14 years. So reading your book, well, it was just helpful on all kinds of levels. And I listened to Art Bell. I've been listening to him for years because I like the that he asks the tough questions, and he takes a detached stance and allows us to come to our own conclusions. And I felt from reading your book, you wrote it in that sort of an intelligent way where you didn't say, I know this for sure. This is just, I'm putting this out there, you decide. And it was an amazing book to read. I've been giving it to my friends. We've sort of been talking about it and calling up other people and talking to them about it because it really transcends gayness or straightness. It's about love. The message was about love, you know, and that it lives on. And Art's always talking about that, and I think it's true. You know?
In writing it, it was that Viktor Frankl thing again. I didn't want to be emotional about the experiences, and I didn't want to editorialize. I just wanted to present them as they happened.
And I felt you. I thought, this guy really wrote from the heart, because when I was reading the words,
try to be straightforward.
It came right off the page, as though I was talking with you.
Thank you.
I thought, how ironic. I really live close to this guy, and I might have met him at some point, you know? And one time, about 8 years ago, when my niece died in Germany, she was in the Navy. She was 22, and she hit a tree and died. I woke up and knew. And when they called me, they say, we're having a hard time getting the body into the country from Germany through all the difficulties they had with the Navy and all the, you know, the red tape. And I heard her voice. I was standing in my room, and she said, I'll be home in 7 days. And she told me when and where and what. And I called my mother, and she says, oh, no, that's impossible. We tried doing that, and they said it couldn't happen. I said, she's going to be there at this time, and it happened.
Signals.
So that was a very unexplainable thing.
Yep.
And it happened to me. And I did hear a voice, and it did come to me like that. And I didn't try to go against it. I just went with it and told the people I needed to be told. And it did happen, you know? How can you explain these things?
Only in the way we're doing that tonight. Thank you. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Joel Rothschild. Hi.
Is that me, Art?
That's you.
Hey, listen, Joel, bear with me just a moment. Art, I have some information related to Danyon Brinkley, Ramona, and some UFO pictures that came my way related to crash sites and
all right,
bodies.
Well, that's fine, sir. I can't do it while we've got a guest on. If you want to get that kind of thing on, you'll have to wait in door and open lines.
Okay, thank you.
Right, thank you. East of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Hi, Art. Great show.
Thank you.
Joel, I have a very strange question. While Albert was still alive, like with my friend, better half of 21 years, he can hear what I think. Did you have any experience like that with Albert?
Great question. One of the strangest things in our relationship is that there was this synchronicity, not hearing things like that,
right,
but we were constantly running into each other. There were odd coincidences our whole life.
Right.
We live on opposite ends of town, in the middle of the, you know, we used to see each other every day, and on a particular day, I would say, well, I'm going downtown, and he'd say, well, I'm going to Long Beach, and we both changed our minds, and we're in the valley and run into each other at a major intersection.
For no reason at all, and you just run into each other.
We constantly right. were having these synchronicities where we were running into each other and odd events like that during our lifetime, during his lifetime when he was, you know, here.
And in Los Angeles, that's pretty synchronistic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty key.
Ankersham Boulevard in Sun Valley when you know, I live in West Hollywood and he lived in L.A.
I really appreciate that.
All right. Well, I really appreciate your call, sir. Thank you. Amazon.com has your book.
Mm-hmm. Selling well there.
Selling well. And I guess selling, it's a good deal for people. I tell them that. I've got a book up there, too, and you can get like a 30% discount or something.
Yep, they've already put it on sale. It's a brand new book, and they've got it on sale.
Oh, they do it right away, actually,
yeah.
From day one. So, did you birth this book with trepidation? Were you wondering how it would be received?
Wow, can you imagine? Art, do you know what it's like to tell the whole world you have AIDS? It's got to be, you know, if you can imagine how scary it is. I mean, and then to talk about these things. Yeah, I mean, tremendous trepidation.
Is that something you kept secret for years and years? And
well, no, I mean, I didn't keep it as a secret, but it's not something that, you know...
You shout from the mountaintop.
It's a difficult thing to tell the whole world. And, you know, these are difficult things to talk about. I'll tell you, I was really inspired. I don't know, did you read Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning?
I have, yes.
It's a brilliant book. And I thought, if, you know, he spoke so honestly and candid about that horror, well, I certainly can talk about my little tragedies.
Little tragedies, not. I think not.
Well, comparing them.
Well, it's a very brave thing you've done, in my opinion, coming forward. Very, very brave. And I don't know, I guess as Spock would say, all I can say to you is I hope you sell a lot of books. I hope a lot of people read them, because those who have responded said they got a lot out of it and really helped them. And as Spock would say, live long and prosper.
And if Spock had one thing that I always wanted to have that I couldn't do with my book, the Vulcan Mind Probe.
Yeah.
Nothing would be a greater gift than to be able to hook up that way, let other people simultaneously know these experiences were real.
That's it.
I wish I would have had it.
Good night, my friend.
Thank you, Art.
Listen, tomorrow night, Peter Davenport is going to be here. And we're going to be, you're going to be hearing lots of very valuable material, because that's what Peter Davenport has. And then Friday, or Thursday night, Friday morning, Matthew Alper comes back. The God Part of the Brain. From the High Desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night.